Welcome to Two-Way Street. I'm Bill Nygut. Alan Alda's acting career has spanned six decades. He started with an appearance on The Phil Silver Show, which was an early network TV comedy hit way back in 1953. In the years since, he's appeared on countless TV shows, including The West Wing, ER, 30 Rock, and many more. Alda's been a star on Broadway and in dozens of feature films. But he's probably always going to be best remembered for his portrayal of Hawkeye Pierce on the beloved TV series MASH. The show ran for 11 seasons, and the finale in 1983 broke the record for the most watched TV series in history at the time, 125 million viewers. But there's another side to Alda that most people don't know about. He's a genuine science geek, a passion which became even stronger during his years hosting the PBS series called Scientific American Frontiers. As you'll hear in our conversation, that series taught him a lot about the difficulties that many scientists and doctors have in communicating clearly to each other and to the rest of us. Alda decided to do something about that. He took the lessons he'd learned as an actor, especially in improvisation classes, and helped develop a program at New York's Stony Brook University that's taught thousands of scientists and doctors how to communicate more clearly. Now he's written a book that distills all that he's learned about communication into lessons for how we can talk to one another more clearly. It's called If I Understood You, Would I Have This Look on My Face? Alan Alda, welcome to Two-Way Street. It's really a pleasure to get to talk to you today.
Thank you. I'm really glad to be here.
You tell us in your new book, in my own experience, people have a harder time understanding what I tell them if I don't tell it as a story. And to prove that point, you actually really begin your book with a wonderful story about you and a dentist and how it set you off on a whole new path in life. What happened at the dentist's office?
The dentist was going to take out a front tooth that I had broken when I was 12 years old. And here I was over the age of 50, and the tooth finally had to come out. And he had invented a procedure that would ensure a blood supply to the socket, which was another way of doing it from how it's ordinarily done. So it involved pulling some tissue of the gum down over the socket. So I thought, well, he knows what he's doing. He invented this. That's fine. And then a second before he's going to cut my face with the scalpel, he says, now there will be some tethering. And I said, what? He said, tethering. I said, what is that? What do you mean? He said, tethering. He started screaming at me instead of telling me what he meant. And I, even though I was old enough to know better, I didn't question him. I didn't say, put the knife down and tell me what you're talking about. You're going to cut into my gum here. What do you mean, tethering? Instead of that, there he was in his white surgical gown, and I let him do it. And then a couple of weeks later, I was making a movie, and I was supposed to smile in a scene. And after the shot, the cameraman came over and said, I thought you were going to smile. You were sneering. I said, no, I was smiling. He said, no. To look in the mirror, you got a sneer on your face. And he had given me a smilectomy, and I didn't know what had happened.
Yeah, he cut your frenum, which is not something I ever knew about.
I didn't know much about it either. It's that little bit of tissue between your gum and your upper lip. And he then, when I told him that I needed my face to smile sometimes because I made a living out of my face, he said he sent me a letter that was totally directed at getting me not to sue him. It was a legal defense. And I thought, this guy is compounding his lack of connection to me. I had never even thought of suing him. He was putting it in my head. I didn't sue him, of course. But it was an interesting experience to be at the other end of such bad communication that directly affected my body, you know? He said there was a second stage to the operation. I don't know if I ever let him back in my mouth. I can't remember. But now I can play villains much better with this smile I got.
Yeah, well, obviously, this experience with the dentist, not communicating with you in a way that was clear and made you aware of what was going to happen, led you down this path that I really obviously want to explore with you, because it led you ultimately to creating a center for communicating science at Stony Brook University. But before we go there, I was fascinated by the fact that you said the good side of what happened was it allowed you to play villains for the first time. I was trying to remember the first time I saw Alan Alda play a villain. I don't remember the role, but I remember I was shocked that Alan Alda would be playing a villainous role.
Well, I think I was exaggerating a little bit to get a laugh when I said that. But
okay.
I actually have played bad guys all my life, you know, on and off. But I must make some kind of impression when I'm not playing a bad guy that makes people say to me, every time I play somebody who's not perfect, they say, gee, I've never done that before. I do it about half the time. In fact, everybody I've ever played has flaws of one kind or another. I like those flaws to show because I think that makes it look more human.
So you decided as a result of this experience that scientists did not do a particularly good job, doctors, scientists of various kinds, needed to learn more about how to communicate with each other, with people outside the sciences. And that led you to think about the value of improvisation as a tool for teaching a better communication. Is that an accurate statement?
Yeah, that's true. And what really kicked me over into that was the interviews I did on Scientific American Frontiers, which was a science program I did on PBS for 11 or 12 years. And that was a very positive experience. It wasn't so much that I realized the people I was talking to weren't communicating well. It was kind of that I saw they were communicating well whenever we made that connection that you get when you do improvisation. If it was a strictly standard kind of interview, which is what happened in the beginning, when I would go in with questions I thought were clever questions, it didn't go nearly as well as it did when I went in just curious, armed with my own natural ignorance plus my curiosity, and tried to understand what they were doing. Then they were focused on helping me understand this one particular person, and they weren't making lectures to an invisible crowd. And the difference was spectacular. The change in their tone of voice, the change in their vocabulary. There was something about their real personalities that emerged, and that was very appealing. And I realized it would be great to teach scientists to do this and also to teach doctors so the barking dentist would disappear from the medical world. And I started this center, helped start the Center for Communicating Science at Stony Brook University. And we've trained over 8,000 scientists and doctors since then.
It's pretty remarkable. I knew nothing about it until I read your book, so congratulations on that. Let's go back to the improvisation aspect of it, because here is an opportunity for you to work what you wanted to do with scientists, your own experience as an actor in improvisation. You had worked with Paul Sills, whose mother was Viola Spolin, who wrote probably the greatest book on improvisation for the theater. Tell us about the kind of games that Viola Spolin wanted actors to play, what those games were supposed to accomplish, and how you applied it to scientists.
First of all, most people think of improvisation as comedy improvisation because that's mostly what they can get commercially on television or in comedy clubs. But the kind of improvisation that Viola Spolin did was much more basic, much more, you could say, a kind of purer form of work. And she would develop scenes that sometimes were very dramatic, but often they were funny not because of jokes, but because of the joy of spontaneity that would emerge.
That's really important, what you're saying. Improv is not about being funny. Improv is about getting to the truth. And when you on the way there, if you're funny, that's great. So that's really a crucial thing that you're saying about improv as a way to get to truth.
It is, and it and what I love about Viola's work is that it enables you to do something that I think is fundamental to acting, and it turns out to be fundamental, in my opinion, to communication in general in real life, which is it helps you relate so fully to the other person that you're reading them. You're reading signals from them that most of the time we ignore when we observe them in one another. We don't observe them. They take place and we have some general idea of it. And it's only in retrospect sometimes that we realize the person we thought we were convincing was actually getting angrier at us the more we talked. And her exercises and games really put you from the very beginning onto the other person. Like the mirror exercise. You must have done the mirror exercise
many times. Describe it for our listeners.
Two players are standing opposite one another, facing each other. And one of them is the mirror for the other, literally trying to be a mirror, as if the first person were looking into a mirror. So as the first person moves, the other person is the mirror image. And the idea is not to have a lag of even a millisecond between the first person and the second person. It's hard to accomplish. And what we find that's really useful to communication is the person who's looking into the mirror realizes after a moment that it's their responsibility to make the person who's the mirror be good at being a mirror. So they have to help them be the mirror. And it's part of the basic idea in improv that you have to make your partner look good, that you don't use your partner like a comic prop. Your partner is, in a way, more important than you are. So that what scientists and doctors have realized over and over in these workshops when they do this exercise, that if they want the people they're talking to or writing for to understand them, it's their responsibility to help them understand, to help them follow, just as it's their responsibility to help the mirror person follow the movements. It's an experience that teaches you an awful lot. You can hear it the way somebody's hearing it now on the radio, and it sounds like an interesting idea. But until you experience that in the flesh, you don't get it, the depth that you get it that way. And we've had doctors and scientists come back to us months later and say, I used that mirror in a certain situation that was emblematic of the situation. They weren't actually mirroring the other person, but they were in the same kind of contact with the other person that they were in the mirror exercise, and they were able to use it to have much more effective communication.
I'm talking with Alan Alda about his new book, If I Understood You, Would I Have This Look on My Face? We're going to continue our conversation with Alda after a break. But first, since the mirror exercise that Alda described is an entirely visual game, and this is, after all, radio, I thought it'd be interesting to share with you a different improv game that gives you another sense of how using improv can facilitate even better communication. You're going to hear Kevin Galese and Amber Nash from Dad's Garage Theater create a story in which each of them can add only one word as they go back and forth. They played the game in our studio last year. First, you'll hear Galese describe the point of the game.
See if you can see where one of us is trying to take something and then the other person takes it somewhere else, and watch us drop whatever we had and try to get on the other person's page.
Love it. You need a suggestion again?
Sure. Yeah.
You know,
maybe just another location.
Jenny says Arabia Mountain in DeKalb County.
Okay. One
day
I
woke
up
as
early
as
I
could
and
donned
my
super
outfit
and
decided
that
I
was
going
to
patrol
the
park,
not
looking
for
criminals,
but
looking
for
dog
droppings.
Because
I
believe
in
cleanliness.
So
I
took
my
trusty
picker
upper
and
went
into
the
park.
It
was
right
about
dawn.
The
air
was
sweet
and
moist
and
hot.
The
birds
were
singing
like
beautiful
musicians.
Looking
around,
I
noticed
that
there
was
a
gigantic
steaming
pile
of
dog
shit.
So
I
went
and
picked
it
up
with
my
picker
upper.
But
it
was
so
big
that
my
picker
upper
broke
in
half,
and
I
was
at
the
mercy
of
the
gods.
That's Amber Nash and Kevin Galese from Dad's Garage Theater. When we come back from a break, a lot more with Alan Alda. Welcome back to Two Way Street. If you're just joining us, my guest is Alan Alda. We're talking about what he's learned from his many years as an actor about communicating more effectively. Alda helped develop a program at New York's Stony Brook University to teach those lessons to doctors and scientists, and now he's written a book which he thinks can help all of us learn to communicate better. It's called, If I Understood You, Would I Have This Look on My Face? Do you mind if I play you something quickly? Because what all this is about, essentially, is learning how to relate to other people. And you tell a story in the book. And if you don't mind, I want to take you back in time and just play you, as we talk about this, something that you'll remember from your past.
She keeps filling up the hut with rubbish, like flowers and plants. And not only is it overcrowded, it's loaded with ants. She is definitely too intrusive, a nuisance. And yet, she's an interesting creature this year.
What show is that from, Alan?
that's The Apple Tree. That was one of the early shows I did on Broadway, and that was directed by Mike Nichols.
And that's why I bring it up, because Mike Nichols told you something that fits into all of what we've been talking about. What did he tell you?
He kept saying to me, you're not relating well enough. Relate better. Relate more. And I didn't know what it meant. I mean, I had heard it so many times from directors and read about it in books by, you know, Stanislavski and all those Obskis. And I thought relating was leaning in and looking into the other person's face. So Mike would say, relate more. I'd lean over further. I was in danger of falling into the other person's face. I didn't realize that relating, you can do relating without even looking at the person, just being totally aware of them. And Mike said to me at one point, you think relating is the icing on the cake. It's not. It's the cake. And for me, it is, now that I've gotten better at it. And when I admire other people's performances, it's because I see them locked in an engagement with the other actor that is so genuine, because something is really happening between them and they're not pretending something's happening. I think it's at its worst in procedural detective stories on television, where they have to shoot the scene really fast and they probably shoot a bunch of close-ups at one time, and the people are not really talking to one another. They're saying their lines in a way that they feel is appropriate, but it's not coming out of the relationship. The thing that's so different about relating is that you don't come in with a performance you figured out the night before. The performance happens because the other person is making it happen in you. You say your next line, not because it's in the script, but because the other person does something or says something that makes you say it, that makes you say it a certain way. And if listening to the other person in real life is like that, then you're a lot less likely to say what you want what you have prepared to say because you think this person just made me think of this and I'm going to say this next, regardless of how this person finishes the sentence.
Yeah. You offer us so many ideas for how we all can learn to communicate better by talking about the science work that you've done. And it is really important what you just said. If conversation is about me just waiting for you to finish what you're saying so I can talk again, we are not really having a conversation.
It doesn't go anywhere. And all I hear is what I've said before. And what I've said before never gets changed. And here's a great opportunity to let you in. And as odd as what you have to say might be, or even if I disagree with it enormously, I can use it to challenge my own thinking and see if maybe my thinking could be improved a little bit. So the next time I launch into this kind of thing, I might take into account your point of view. And then we get somewhere. It's like a collaboration. I think communication is a partnership. It's not spraying stuff at the other person.
Can I go back to the apple tree for just a minute?
Sure.
Because it was a wonderful moment in Broadway theater. I mean, it was you ran for more than a year with that show, I believe, didn't you? And you worked with, I mean, Barbara Harris was in that show with you. Had you worked with Barbara Harris at
Second City a little bit?
Second City, sure.
Yeah.
Sure.
And Barbara was a brilliant actress. I think she was the best actress on the stage anywhere in the country at that time. She was just extraordinary. She could be anything. She could be an untidy teenager or a glamorous movie star. She could do anything. I saw her. Let me tell you about how amazing she was. In rehearsal, I watched her doing a song where she magically transforms from a chimney sweep to a glamorous movie star. And I'm watching her as the chimney sweep, and I think, gee, she's really just right to play this. She's got those stubby fingers and those thick ankles, and she looks like she's been working hard all her life. And then a second later, with no makeup, no wardrobe, she transforms into the movie star, and I think, holy moly, look at those skinny, long fingers and those beautiful ankles. I don't know how she did it.
You sounded very sweet singing, and I hadn't heard that album for a while until I
had a nice voice, didn't
it.
I? That was
you did have a nice voice. Why didn't we see Ellen Alda doing more musicals over the years?
I don't know. The only other musical I did was called Cafe Crown about Second Avenue Theater, and almost closed during the intermission.
So you said a really crucial thing, and you talk about it in the book. Listening is as much a part of the experience as figuring out how to relate when you're talking, when you're trying to tell a story.
Yeah, I think you have to do more listening. You got to constantly be monitoring the other person.
And you really have to listen. So, for instance, there are plays, and I'm curious if you've been in this experience, where you on stage have to, night after night, listen to another character give a long speech. And the remarkable thing is that while the audience is focused on the talker, if you're really doing the part, you are listening every night. You're not just waiting, you're listening. Have you had that experience?
Yeah, I have. And I find sometimes the way you listen, and if you really take in what the other person is saying, that can become cues for what the other person says next. Mm-hmm. You don't have to actually say something to cue what the other person is about to say. Because listening in real life is usually a two-way street, just like this show. and it really is an exchange between two people, whether the other person is talking or not. Sometimes when the other person doesn't talk, that's the biggest cue of all.
You talk about empathy a lot in the book, and you say something interesting. You say that you were suspicious of empathy at first. First of all, how would you describe what empathy really is, and why were you suspicious of it?
I was suspicious of it. I'll answer that part first. I was suspicious of it because it seemed like a new agey, loosey-goosey, gooey kind of sentimental position to take. I know how you feel. I feel your pain. I don't believe people when they say I feel your pain. At least I didn't when I first heard it. On the contrary, Well, first of all, I think that there are many definitions people use to describe empathy or to understand what it is. And for many people, it includes the idea of compassion. People feel that there's a necessary connection. Some people feel that there's a necessary connection between an empathic reaction to somebody and then taking good action to benefit those people, compassionate action. I don't think that's true. So for me, empathy is simply knowing what the other person is feeling or having a pretty good estimate of what they're feeling. And that's a tool. It's not, it doesn't make you automatically a better person, in my opinion, because if you have the impulse to be connected, to be related to the other person, empathy is a really powerful way to do it. If you have the impulse, on the other hand, to bully the other person, empathy is also a powerful way to do that. Mm-hmm. Bullies know what you're feeling, know how to manipulate your feelings, make you feel terrible. Interrogators know how to use your feelings to make you helpless and say anything they want you to say. Empathy, to me, is just a tool. You don't get the Nobel Prize for having empathy.
It's interesting to me as we talk about empathy and your emphasis on it in the book. As you embark, as you go out on the tour for this book, it strikes me that you are going to find yourself in a number of situations you probably already have where people are going to inject the politics of today into the dialogue. Empathy. There's a lot of talk these days about whether Donald Trump has empathy, understands it. How are you feeling about the possibility? How are you trying to avoid getting political with this book? Are you hoping that these conversations won't happen, or are you glad to plunge in?
No, the question often arises. I decided about 25 or 30 years ago, after I spent 10 years working really hard to help get the Equal Rights Amendment ratified around the country, that I had done my share and I didn't want to talk about politics anymore in public. I'm still a citizen and really interested in politics. But I don't talk about it in public because I want to concentrate on what I think I do best. So I haven't talked about the present administration. But I will say that you could make the argument that Trump doesn't have compassion for people around him. I've heard people say that. But I think it's hard to say he doesn't have empathy because he's very effective in front of an audience. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And you have to be able to read the audience to do that.
Let's take another break right now. We'll continue our conversation with Alan Alda in a moment. Welcome back to Two-Way Street. My guest is Alan Alda. You probably know him as the star of the hit TV series MASH, or his roles on The West Wing, 30 Rock, and countless other TV shows, and for his starring roles in dozens of feature films. Today we're talking about how his work as an actor taught him lessons in how we can better communicate. That's the subject of his new book, If I Understood You, Would I Have This Look on My Face? Obviously, everyone remembers your years on the incredible TV series MASH. And you tell us a good story about your experience on that show. You talk about the fact that on a film set, when you have downtime, typically you're in your trailer, you're watching, they're relighting, they're resetting cameras, whatever, and often actors are isolated in their own trailers. But you tell us that isn't what happened on the MASH set. Tell us what did happen.
I think we all had the instinctive understanding that these people we were playing were living in under tremendous stress and had been drawn together and had an intimate understanding and relationship with one another. And I think in order to achieve that, we got to be friends really fast. It was very cold the week we made the pilot, and we were out in the mountains, and we were all playing in Hawaiian shirts in spite of the fact that it was almost freezing. And we all would huddle around oil drums with fires going in them, and we'd hug one another and try to get warm. And we got close very fast. And in those hours, for the rest of the series, for 11 years, in those hours while they were lighting the sets between shots, most of the time we did not go to our dressing rooms. We sat around in a circle and talked and laughed and made fun of one another. And it just kept the connection going, so that when they called us to the set, on the few feet we walked from the chairs to the set, we were still laughing and kidding. Mike Farrell was trying to trip me, and that guy, you know, we had a strange running gag that he would just put his feet under mine, and I'd see if he could make me fall down on the way to the set. But that lighthearted air, the connection we had, continued right straight through the scene, but with the dialogue and the emotions that the scene called for. But the connection was always there. And that connection, I think, is one of the things that the audience sensed and one of the reasons that they came back for more.
When you see MASH, as you're flipping through TV channels and see a rerun of MASH coming up, how do you react to that? Do you still find it? Do you look at it with warmth and affection, or is it more like, oh, my gosh, I've seen this over and over?
Well, I haven't seen it over and over. I haven't watched it. I haven't watched all the shows since we did them. Once in a while, I would see one. I only see them flipping channels. So it's in the past for me. I don't think about the past much. I'm very proud of what we did, but I don't dwell on it. And I don't even look back at it. And if there's a scene that I could have acted better, I don't say, oh my God, I should have done that. But that's what it was. You know, it was a stepping stone. It's like improv. You know, when you do improv, there's no mistakes. You just move on. A mistake is just the new circumstance, and now you got to cope with that.
So I want to, before, we've only got a few more minutes, and I want to make sure that our listeners get a better sense of how you have worked with things like improvisation to help scientists communicate more effectively. And I think one of the interesting stories about that is Yvonne Kaplan-Liss. Here's what I think is fascinating about your introducing her in the book, because you tell us stories matter. But one of the things you tell her about her, to really tell us about her, to really kind of focus us on her, is that she came in right behind Andrea McArdle for the part of Annie in the Broadway show.
I know. She could have been a big star if Andrea McArdle had a cold that day, you know?
She had a great many surgeries for problems that she had, and she came to work at your Stony Brook Institute, right?
Right, and she's a doctor herself now. She was a performer, then a journalist, then a doctor, so she has the perfect background to deal with communication, especially in medicine.
You tell about an anesthesiologist who heard her talk, and as a result of her lecture, he changed the way that he communicated with his patients, right?
Yeah, and you know, that surprised me, because I know Yvonne is a wonderful speaker. She's really extraordinary. But I'm always saying that just hearing the concept doesn't really change you. You got to go through experiences. Mm-hmm. And yet, this person changed the way. There was a woman, by the way, it was a woman and anesthesiologist, and she said she used to go in and say to the patient, here's what's going to happen to you, this is what's going to take place, and she would go into the details of the anesthesia, And she was proud of herself that she was telling the patient all that the patient needed to know. And after she heard Yvonne speak about really relating to the patient, letting the patient know that they were in safe hands, helping the patient come to terms with what was going to happen in a personal way, she now says, now I go in and I say, I'm your anesthesiologist and I'm going to make sure you're safe and comfortable.
Yeah.
And she says she could see the patient visibly relax. And then she goes into the details. But first she makes this contact with the person and lets the person know that things are going to be okay, that she's in a caring relationship. She has a caring stance toward the person. And that, you know, that's so different from one exercise I saw, a role-playing exercise where the doctor came in. There were two medical students. One was playing the doctor and the other was playing the patient. So the one playing the doctor comes in, doesn't say a word, doesn't even look at the patient, goes over to the sink and washes his hands. And afterwards we said, why did you come into the room and not relate to the patient? And he said, well, I was taught before an examination, the first thing you do is wash your hands. We said, right, well, you could have said hi. And little by little, they get tuned into the idea that the patient is not a bag of symptoms or a diseased organ. The patient is a person who could be their mother or sister. And you got to relate to them that way. And they learn to do that because, you know, it's a great responsibility they have. I've always been in awe of doctors who could take on the responsibility of my health, sometimes my life. And that's a courageous thing to do. So they have a lot on their minds. And now we're asking them to have all of that technical stuff on their minds and make sure they're making the right decisions. And in addition, comfort us. In addition, relate to us. So it's a big job we're asking them to do, but it's part of the medical experience. And it also means money to hospitals. You know, I mean, we're starting to see a lot of hospitals want training in communication because now patients take a little exit survey, and if they don't rate the doctor as caring and empathic, they don't get as much money.
You know, it's remarkable, as I've read your book, to think about the fact that you have had such an exceptional career as an actor, and we all know your work over so many years. And yet, at this stage in your life, science and helping scientists understand each other, how to communicate better, seems to have moved into the forefront. Your whole life has turned into science.
Not my whole life. I still act and I write, but I think I spend most of my time helping people communicate better. And it makes me communicate a little better. At least, I mean, it sounds like I think I communicate great, but I am better than I was before. So it's not so bad. But I do. It's just, you know what it is? It's something that I've found that I can be helpful with. And that feels awfully good if you can actually be helpful. So I spend a lot of time doing it. And it's not just scientists and doctors. And that's what the book is about. It's really taking what I've learned from that and showing how it works with everybody in every field, husbands and wives, parents and children, bosses and employees, collaborations, salesmanship. I mean, what's interesting is you can turn every one of those situations from a tense, hard task into something that's actually fun for both people. Since I've been writing the book, I've personally been changed by paying attention to the things I'm writing about. And I find people less annoying in regular life. That's a great benefit to me.
Can I play one last thing for you and then we'll say goodbye? In 1981, you released The Four Seasons, which you wrote, you starred in, and it was a wonderful picture. That many of us loved. But I want to play you, if I may, just a brief speech. You're sitting at dinner with one of your dearest friends, your wife, played by Carol Burnett, and you sitting at dinner with Jack Weston. And Jack Weston, you're kind of making fun of him, and Jack Weston talks to you about his feelings. Let's just listen to a brief part of that.
Let me tell you something, Jack. I'm 10 years older than you, right?
Yeah.
Right, I just hope that when you get to be my age, you don't smell the foul breath of death and disintegration hanging over your shoulder the way I find it hanging over mine. I mean, I go to sleep at night on an ache so bad that it simply will not go away. I wake up in the middle of the night sweating, hearing my own bones decaying. I have shifted into a state of entropy that's progressing geometrically.
You see? Entropy. Progressing geometrically. You talk like a bad textbook. Why don't you just speak English?
God damn it! I just told you my deepest fear!
He made me smile during that. Jack Weston was a brilliant actor.
You must have been in your 40s when you wrote that speech.
Yeah.
And now it's 2017. And I wonder if that speech stayed with you and if you hear it in a different way today than you did when you were in your 40s.
Oh, that's a good question. Actually, hearing it reminded me that I was actually writing about things I was experiencing then myself. I had a bad shoulder. I had a shoulder I finally had to have an operation on. And when I slept on that side of my body, I was in pain all night.
I've been there.
So I was the Jack Weston character that I was writing about. The funny thing about things now, because I'm 81 now, and parts of my body don't work so well anymore. I can't see as well. I can't hear as well. And my fingers are getting number. You know, it's just everything, all your connections with the outside world start to diminish. And the difference between me now and then is I think I've learned to adapt. And I have fun adapting. And I don't curse my fate and say, I wish I had my feeling back. I wish I had my sight back. You know, I mean, I'm not going blind. It's hard to read without glasses and bright light, but that can be annoying. I'm very grateful that this has happened to me. Instead of being annoyed by it, I have fun seeing how well I can adapt, and I try to adapt better every day. So I just have a new way of approaching it, which is good because there's plenty to deal with as time goes on.
And you have maintained what you're very fortunate about, I think, is that this passion, both for your performance work, but also your work in science, keeps you going every day, I would think.
It does. There's always something new to learn and to put thoughts together and try to figure out what smart people are doing. There's one of the most beautiful things in nature to me is somebody else's brain working at an optimal way. And to just hear them come to conclusion, it's the same reason we love detective stories like Elementary, My Dear Watson, what's his name?
Sherlock Holmes.
Sherlock Holmes, yeah. I mean, that's an appreciation of rational thought. We're binge watching now a murder mystery, a documentary series called The Keepers, which is extraordinary. But one of the things that makes it so interesting to watch is you're trying to figure out who did what. And that exploratory deductive reasoning is what we all go through all the time, but scientists go through it on speed, you know, and they're fascinating to watch. So there's always something to be entertained by watching nature, especially that part of nature, which is the brain that is the nature knowing itself.
Well, Alan Alda, your book, if I understood you, would I have this look on my face, subtitled My Adventures in the Art and Science of Relating and Communicating, shows us that you have not stopped thinking. Working in areas that matter a great deal to you. And it's been a real pleasure to talk to you and to have had a chance to read your book. So, Alan Alda, thanks so much for being with us for Two-Way Street today.
Thank you, Bill. I really had fun talking with you.
Oh, I'm glad to hear that.
Thanks so much.
Alan Alda's new book is called If I Understood You, Would I Have This Look on My Face?
my adventures in the art and science of relating and communicating. If you're a regular listener to the weekday schedule here at GPB Radio, you may be hearing Two Way Street for the first time today. And starting today, we'll be with you every Thursday at 2. For those of you who've been listening to us on Sunday mornings at 11, we'll continue to rebroadcast in that weekly time slot. Two Way Street is all about conversations with creative people in many fields, authors, musicians, chefs, scientists doing intriguing research, actors, directors, and much more. And the key to every conversation we produce is storytelling. We choose guests who we think have great stories to share with you. Here are some of the guests we have coming up in the weeks ahead. Pulitzer Prize-winning novelist Richard Russo joins me to talk about his new book of stories. One of them is based on what happened when he sent his good friend Paul Newman pages from a screenplay he just written and hoped Newman would do.
And I sent it to him, and very quickly after that, I got a response from Paul saying, "Richard, these pages sparkle, but I'm awfully afraid I'm going to have to say no. As a matter of fact, it's become clear to me that I can't act anymore. I'm just not going to be able to do this." As you can imagine, my heart was broken.
Georgia Tech robotics expert Ayanna Howard talks about why we love and loathe robots.
Robots, the reason they're special versus, say, you know, computers or tablets or smartphones is that robots are the closest to an emulation of us. And it's also why we're also so terrified of them. When we think about robotic systems, we really think of them as part of our society, as playmates and healthcare workers and possibly workers that are working alongside us in the manufacturing environment.
John T. Edge, director of the Southern Foodways Alliance, shares stories about the history of Southern cooking, including the Atlanta Constitution's great cornbread and pot liquor debate of 1931, which asked the burning question, what's the proper way to eat cornbread?
The beautiful thing about it, though, and it's people began writing in to the editor of the Constitution, voicing their views about cornbread and pot liquor and the way to eat it. But they end up writing about racism. They end up writing about gender politics. They end up writing about regional identity. They write about everything.
And next week, David Barron, who chases total eclipses of the sun around the world, will be here to help prepare us all for the total eclipse that will send a swath of North Georgia into complete darkness in August.
What first took me to see a total eclipse was the science of it. But that's not what keeps me going back. It's, I guess the word is spiritual. You know, I'm not religious in any traditional sense. But for me, looking up in the sky and seeing the sun as this beautiful kind of woven object that's shimmering out there, that it makes me feel like I am part of something much larger than myself. It both humbles me and kind of makes me feel bigger than myself.
So in the weeks ahead, I hope you'll join us for Two Way Street, Thursdays at 2, with the rebroadcast Sunday mornings at 11. You can learn more about our show and our guests by going to our website at gpb.org/TWS. And we're on Facebook, too. If you visit, be sure to like us. If you're not near a radio when we're on the air, you can subscribe to our podcast on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. In addition, you'll find all of our shows archived on the Two Way Street website. You can find our past conversations with country music legend and Georgia native Whisperin' Bill Anderson, best-selling crime writer Carl Hyacin, humorist Dave Barry, Tony Award-winning director Kenny Leon, and many more. I also want to point out that if you're a political junkie, and who isn't these days, nothing's changed about our show Political Rewind. We're still on the air live Mondays and Wednesdays at 2 and Fridays at 3. Tomorrow, former Democratic gubernatorial candidate Jason Carter will be among our guests. Thank you. Our senior producer is the respectfully rakish Jenny Amond. Our producer is the resiliently resourceful Lisa Clark. Our assistant producer is the resignedly rational Olivia Rheingold. Our engineer is the remarkably renowned Tyler Morris. And special thanks to our intern, Peyton Hawkins. And thanks again to Dad's Garage performers Kevin Galise and Amber Nash for their contributions to today's show. See you next week.
Wow.
The end.